Philadelphia, Philadelphia, are you ready? City of brotherly love, home of smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time. FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby. Come on.
Hey, Philly. It's your girl, Christina Reyes, with Jill Talk. Before I get started, I wanted to let the audience out there listening to know the reasoning behind Jill Talk. The show is about conversations related to what's taking place with the prison system, the effects that it has on all parties impacted by the system, such as those who are survivors of violence, individuals incarcerated, families, and communities. My goal is bringing more awareness to the side effects of prison and helping those who aren't aware to become educated, because this can happen to anyone. On today's show, we have Michael Butler, who was formerly incarcerated and has become a major advocate and influencer in Pennsylvania, speaking on mass incarceration and fighting for his brothers and sisters in there. He is currently the director of Fountain Fund and is working in collaboration with Systematic Reformative Change. The first thing I want to say is thank you for taking the time out to be on my show, Jill Talk. And Michael, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just listening to you.
I want to know, how does it feel to be back home?
It feels good to be home. It feels good to be free. It feels good to, you know, finally get a chance to, you know, experience life as I should. So definitely, I'm grateful.
One of the things that I really love is that you and me have been friends since like the start of you first coming home. Remember that? And we kind of like collaborated because we were going into those meetings that had to do with Man Up and, you know, just talking to other people that were coming home, but just also talking about some of the issues within the prison system that needed to change. And I kind of like, you know, appreciate that, because I've seen your transition even from like when you initially came home, maybe 2 months into coming home, which has been like a beautiful thing to actually see from how you started to where you are in this moment. And what I do want the audience to know, because I know you very well, but, you know, talk about your backstory before even getting incarcerated.
My mom and my dad met up in 82. I had a pretty, you know, in between, you know, upbringing. My father and my mother, they split up, so I was raised by a single mother, but, you know, my father always was around. My father lived in the suburbs of Pennsylvania, and, you know, basically I grew up in West Philly. It was tough because, you know, having to fit in was like a real big deal for me. You know, I had to be extra, you know, aggressive in Philadelphia, and then I had to tone it down in the suburbs. And, you know, as a child, you know, that mental transition is a thing to do. And most of the times, like, you're either becoming super aggressive and, you know, doing things that you don't want to, or, you know, you become, you know, this person that, you know, just doesn't know where to fit in at. And basically that was kind of, you know, the things that I went through. Definitely had great parents. My mom made sure she kept me, you know, involved. When I was young, I did some TV, did some singing with my father. And, you know, eventually graduated high school and did a year of college. And, you know, that's when the story started to turn. So that's just a little bit about before I, you know, got incarcerated.
And so how old were you at that time?
The time I got incarcerated?
Yes.
Oh, I was about, I was 18 years old. I just graduated high school. I graduated high school and I just got a year down of college and, you know, I was 18 going on 19.
Okay. So what was that experience like for you, first of all, being 18 years old? You know, you did 1 year of college and you're like in that transitional phase of being young and trying to like figure out what type of career you're trying to go into. And, you know, you were doing the right thing because you were trying to get your education. And then you get your situation, you get yourself into a situation that leads to prison. Mm-hmm. And now you're kind of transitioning in a whole different direction of what you were trying to do.
Right. again, like, I just felt like as a child, like, you know, continuous running, whether it was running from, the stigmas of, you know, the inner city, or whether it was running from trying to live up to what, you know, my father or my mother may have wanted me to be. So at that point in time, when I was a child, it was just continuous running for me, like not knowing exactly who I was. So I hear what you're saying, like you kind of had it together and you was, you know, I didn't really, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, just I never really was settled. So going to prison, I think the benefit for me was is that I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what to expect. You know what I'm saying? Like I didn't, of course I had family members incarcerated like in Philadelphia, who doesn't, but you know, I didn't know what to expect. So once I got in there, like everything that happened to me was basically like, well, it was supposed to happen. This is supposed to be jail. So that's kind of how I coped with, you know, first coming into prison. I've never been a person who was really submissive to authority. I had issues with that. So I guess, you know, that was one of the biggest transitions for me, like someone telling me what to do and I have to listen to it. And I think when I was about my first year in prison, like it was just one thing that my dad had always said to me, you know, it's going to come a time where somebody's going to tell you something to do and you're not going to like it, but they're not going to love you. At least, you know, me, I'm telling you what to do and you don't like it, but you know that I love you. It's going to feel different when someone's telling you something and they don't love you. And like, I kind of like heard his words in my head, like, about a year in the prison, and I was like, damn, that's what he meant. So, you know what I mean? That's kind of like was my introduction into the prison system.
What about like just going into the prison system at 18 years old and then just being around a whole bunch of strangers? Was that like...
Well, listen, man, I ain't gonna hold you, and it's not like... You know, that's about, like when I first got in prison, man, it was like I saw my neighborhood, Tina. Like, literally, the people that I grew up with that you don't even know that's missing because you living your life, they was there. So when I got there, it was like I was in West Philly. Like, when I stepped in Greaterford and I went on a block, I just heard them calling my name. And at that time, you know, they called me Julio because I was the only Spanish guy around the neighborhood. So that was my nickname. I just heard a lot of people call, hey, Julio, Julio. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like... It kind of was like, you know, you scared because you walk in a fort and them big ass, you know, those cell blocks is crazy. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, when I got there, it was like I was on the street, and that's not a good thing. But that was just the environment that, you know, they created in there. So when I first got there, it was scary in a sense that, you know, I'm going into this foreign land. But I had comfort because damn near most of the people that I grew up with and went to grade school with was there. So it was like I was on a block just with no girls. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's a great way to put it because, you know, we live in these communities that there's so many people that get incarcerated because if we knock on everybody's door, or even if you were to go into a school and ask kids, like, do you have someone in your family incarcerated? I'm sure mm-hmm. they're going to say yes, especially when you live in an urban community. So the right. fact that you're saying you're going into another place and you still felt comfortable because you still seen familiar faces, but these were familiar faces that weren't no longer in the community. Mm-hmm. So that was a great way to depict it. Right. So what was it like for you when you're in these circumstances and you're trying to create personal growth for yourself mm-hmm. under the DOC, which a lot of people, if you don't know, it is so hard right. to find that right. and to actually receive it.
Yeah, for sure. Most people that's probably tuning in to your station, you know, prison is a place to stay. It's designed to keep you where you are, right? It's not a place that's designed to elevate your mind, because if it was that way, then they would be out of business, right? So I tend to look at it like that. I think a lot of my personal growth and probably was like instilled in me just being young from my father and from my mother. You know what I'm saying? Like my mom always kept me in books. She always wanted me to elevate myself. And my father just was like this hard worker that seemed to like whatever he did, whatever he put his mind to, he would get it accomplished. You know what I'm saying? So whatever they gave me, I had that in me. And it wasn't easy, because at first it was I was being a rebel. You know what I'm saying? I was in a place that I didn't want to be. I felt like, you know, the system wasn't great to me. So it was like F the world. You understand? So I think the transition came when I met my great friend Tyree Wallace, who was like a brother to me. And we were in a college class, and you know, he spoke. Like, I'm not sure if you've ever got a chance to speak to him, but when he speaks, man, it's like, it's very like, it catches you. And this person, I heard this person speaking, and it was like he had so much enthusiasm and vigor for life, and it's like he couldn't wait to get out to like shine that on the world. And then, like, at the end of his speech, he told me that he had life. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, life. Mm-hmm. And it kind of tore me up, because it's like, damn, how can this man feel this way about all the things he feels great about? And he's never leaving this place. Well, that's what they say. He's never leaving. So that kind of turns into me to be like, who the hell am I to be, you know what I mean, like still stuck in these positions that I'm stuck in? And I have a date to get out, to like make a change in this world, or to like change circumstances. You know what I'm saying? I need to start to work myself in that way. And I think that's just what I did. I reverted back to the teachings from my father and my mother. And I started to, you know, not that I wasn't educating myself, but I started to do it intentionally. You know what I'm saying? I started to educate myself intentionally. And what that means is I started to educate myself about this new man that was going to enter the world after 17 years, meaning what was going on in our society, what was our current events, what was the things that I was going to face being a person that was going to come home with a record, being on parole. I just started to educate myself. And by educating myself, I was able to create certain curriculums and certain programs that not only would teach myself, but would teach my people when I went home. So that, you know, being in prison is just not a place for self-growth, but, you know, you kind of got to like dig within yourself, because it's not a place that's built for that. It's a place to, you know, keep you the same way you are. It's a place to keep you stuck. It's a place for detachment from reality. It's not a place that, you know, wants you to be better, because if that was the case, like I said at the beginning of this, then they would be out of a job. So, you know, you kind of gotta, I had to find it within myself and like-minded people who were around me to kind of give me strength to continuously get better so that I can make my situation different, which would in turn make it different for those that was around me.
I hear that very often, that people say that initially when they first go into prison, mm-hmm. they do go through like a phase of rebellion. And I think that part of it is kind of like sitting with what you've been told and knowing that you're in this prison and the circumstances are really bad, because it's not to rehabilitate people. And you really got to find that amongst yourself. Like you said, it had to be intentional, and you had to want that growth in order to, like, you know, do better things and being proactive. But right. I hear that a lot and very often. How was it for you staying connected with your relationships with individuals outside of prison, whether it's family, friends, romantically? Because I feel like that's something that is often very difficult. People feel handicapped, and you know, sometimes their families and friends outside or even advocates are their legs.
Right. Just before I answer that, just to touch back on something that you said about the rehabilitation, I just want, like, the people that's out there that's listening that, you know, may not know too much about prison or the systems that they have in place. When we talk about rehabilitation and why it's not working, like, you got to understand that a lot of people that are in these systems, what are you rehabilitating them to? You know what I'm saying? Like, how can you rehabilitate someone that never knew the correct way in the first place? Like, rehabilitation needs to take back to its natural form. So if I never learned certain things to do that, you know, that was supposed to be the right way or the correct way, how can you rehabilitate me to something without first teaching me what it was or how I'm supposed to act? So that's just number one. So this is why prisons are not places for rehabilitation, because it's like a one-size-fits-all type of thing, and everybody is not on the same level with understanding, with learning, with love, with care, with any of that. So that's why I feel like it fails right there at the beginning. As far as how I kept my people, Tina, for real, like, the people that stayed around with me was the people that loved me. You know what I mean? Not the people on the streets that I did things for, that I thought, you know, that loved me and I was riding out for them. They were the first ones to go. You know what I'm saying? Because that's not what they like calls for. Like, the people that stayed with me were the people that loved me from the beginning. My father, which is like my number one person, still my best friend to this day. Like, you know, I look up to Pop, like, you know, he's my hero in a lot of ways. My mom, obviously, my siblings, and I got four friends. I got three best friends that I knew since I was about 8 that have never been in the carceral system or even touched it other than me. They just, like, you know, they just loved me for 17 years, man, and it never left my side. And it was just because they loved me, who I was, and you know, how I showed love to them. As far as romantic relationships, of course, we all try, you know what I'm saying? But it sometimes it's just not realistic. A lot of times, behind the wall, the demands that we put on our family members, our girlfriends, or whatever the case may be, we have very big demands, because most of the times we're not in touch with reality out there. We're not in touch with how the world is working every day. So because we're not in touch with that, it makes it hard for romantic relationships to stay the test of time. And I was always the type of person that I didn't blame anybody for that. You know what I'm saying? I might treat you, I might not rock with you when I get out, but but I, you know, I understood. Feel me? Like, because I've always been a person that, like, I try to put myself in that position. If you was in there and I was out here, what would I be doing? Yeah, I might write you a little more. I might send you some more money, but I'm probably going to play the field too, especially
when you talk about how young I was, I couldn't even imagine someone at 18 staying with me till I got out. Like, that's not even realistic. So, romantic relationships was definitely, you know, but, you know, the people that stayed right with my family, not my friends outside of, you know, my best friends, Gigi, Brian, and Rhonda, but I really don't look at them as friends. I look at them as my family. I tried to get you to meet them before you go busy. You know how you are, so.
I'm going to go hang out with y'all, okay? I can't wait to meet them. You know what I was going to ask? I was going to ask, like, having the perspective of, you know, you being inside and then you're talking about, like, keeping these relationships connected. You know, I know that your friend Tyree is also still in prison right now because he's serving a life sentence. Yeah. How is it for you now being on the other side and staying connected with him? How has that been? Because, you know, once you get out here, it's so many different things that you got to do on a day to day. And I feel like at times when a person's incarcerated, you know, the time over there is different than the time out here. And I feel like sometimes that can play a part in how these relationships can kind of have, like, you know, different views.
Right. Listen, I'm the good thing about Tyree is that Tyree has a big network. So, you know, I'm not on the hook to be the person every day. But I do stay connected with Tyree, whether it's a phone call, whether it's the Connect network, format or platform. But I think how I keep in contact with him the most is just by keeping his name alive and, you know, doing things in his name. I think I always try to make it a point to people know that person has changed my life. You know what I mean? In a lot of ways, as far as kind of like helping to create the person that I am today. Creating a person that cares for people as much as I care for people today. A person that advocates for people as much as I do. I owe a lot of it to him because it wasn't something that I was going to do. I kind of like, you know, reserved myself to being a barber when I got home. You know what I'm saying? I didn't being no when you got a record, they kind of like try to box you and put you in certain things when, you know, you got that felony on your back and you didn't think that, you know, you could do too many things. But beating Tyree, he kind of like helped me open that mindset up, along with some other people that I met along the way. But Tyree was a person that always like to say the things that I forgot that I had in me, I like to say that he saw. He was able to get me to reconnect with them, and I just met them. So, like, he's a special person to me, and I try to keep that connection with him, whether it's through sending money, whether it's the platform with the Connect Network, or just be out here, just being busy in his name.
One thing that I do want to say is the fact that I really love that you have that bond with him. And that, you know, you've entered a space even coming home, because sometimes people come home and they're not necessarily for the cause afterwards because they get so tied up in their life and just trying to transition back into society that you might not hear from your friend for a while. And I know that you have been a major advocate talking about Man Up, talking about Tyree's story, about trying to get him home. So I really commend you on that because, you know, I also want to say, too, sometimes people say, OK, do you think prison saved your life? But it's not about prison. It's about the men and the women that are in prison right now, especially the lifers, because we got to give credit to them, that are mentoring, that are giving advice, that are making those transformative transitions for change, that are, you know, giving hope to other people and telling the ones that are coming back out here, you know, like, yo, you need to step your game up. You need to be there for your family. Like, this is not the life that you want. And I really want to commend those individuals, too, that are on the inside as well.
Right.
The question that I have for you next, right, Michael, is do you think there is a difference in the way that individuals are sentenced based on their race or genders at times? Because, I mean, you were incarcerated for a really long time. Yeah. And I just want to say, like, I know that personally you didn't do anything to harm anyone mm-hmm. in your situation, but you were given a very harsh sentence.
Right, right. I mean, I would be a fool not to say that race, gender, social status doesn't play a role in how we're sitting in the criminal justice system. So for sure, to answer your question, yes, it does play a role. It does play a role. That's what I could say, unless you want to speak to something else.
What do you, what advice or input would you give to the DOC, the Department of Corrections, for those of you who don't know or others unaware about these issues taking place within the prison system, like to create change? Because I feel like we have a prison system and this system is not working. I don't know who put this system together. I mean, I do know who put the system together.
Right, right.
But the system is not working. It's not designed to work. So you being a part of that system at one point, what do you feel needs to change? Because you mentioned people not having a first chance to begin with. You mentioned mm-hmm. people not being aware of being rehabilitated because if, you know, they're normalized in their communities based off of trauma mm-hmm. and different things that they're experiencing. So mm-hmm. how would you change that system, or what input would you give coming from that system to the DOC, the Department of Correction?
I mean, well, there's a couple things that we could do. I think number one, when you just look at statistics, that if you have to go into that system, the statistics say that the more education you give people, the better outcome you have when you return home, right? So we could talk about the education in prisons. I think that is a, you know, a big deal. I also think that in order to change the system, it has to start to become a reformative system, right? We have to start practicing forms of reformative justice, because if we don't, then everybody is going to be unhealed. There's not going to be pathways for people to return with their dignity back, whether that's victim or a person that has been victimized. I mean, a person that has been victimized or a person that's perpetrating the harm has to be roadways opened up for people to, like, you know, be able to redeem themselves. And I don't think it's just one thing that, you know, can help this corrupted prison system. Like I said, it was built corrupt. It was built corrupted. It was built upon not being fair. So I don't see how, unless you get rid of it, you can make it fair. I don't think it'll ever be fair. But what I think that could help is that, you know, when someone goes into prison, because we have to have it here, we don't know anything else here in the United States, we don't know other forms of, you know, rehabilitation or whatever you want to call it. I think it has to be reformative from day one. I think a person re-entry into the world has to start from day one when they get sentenced, whether that's keeping family closer, whether that's giving people options and pathways to rectify the wrong that they've done in the community, helping heal those relationships that have been broken. I think it's so many things that can start to help the situation. Will it do it? Probably not. But I think that starts with the people. I think that starts with our politicians. I think that starts with our judges. It starts with the policing. It's just a whole system. Mass incarceration is built upon a bunch of corrupt things, whether that's the police in the neighborhood, whether that's the policies that's written, whether it's the prison system themselves, et cetera, et cetera. I think when it starts to produce inequality, whether racial or social, then, you know, it becomes a corrupted system and becomes hard to fix if you don't start undoing some of the.
One thing I do want to say, besides you mentioning it being corrupted, is the fact that I feel like prisons capitalize on people who are already in poverty, you know, because when you have to pay for phone calls, when you have to pay for messaging systems, when you have to help someone that's in prison because they're making coins so that they can live. I also feel like, you know, it's also a moneymaker, and it's affecting a community that's already in need of resources. A lot of times we talk about, you know, designing more prisons or reconstructing them so that we can have them in different areas, but they're not having them in areas that are close to us. I mean, these places are far out and away from your families, and we don't talk about how they're trying to keep you away from your family members, opposed to working towards, you know, keeping you connected.
Well, it goes to basically what mass incarceration is. It's that network that you're talking about. It's that network of incarceration, that network of debt. It's that network of social control. And it's built, that's built upon reproducing economic racial inequality, right? Depression on top of it. Like you said, like in most of our prisons, MPA, most of the people from Philly is out of town. And we're not in these communities that's getting money to house us. And on top of it, you know, they build these shopping plazas and now they got rules when the family members come up into the jail. Well, you can't wear that shirt in there. So where do they go? They start putting money into that community that, you know, they got us housed in. And like you said, we're far away from home. They don't have these places at home. So we're getting other places rich off of the backs of, you know, the people that's 3 hours, 4 hours away. And, you know, once they release us, they don't release us with that money to go back in our community and help our community. They keep that money out there. So, you know, like, it's definitely terrible system, but you know, we got some good people on the ground, like my bro Salim Holbrook, and you know, people like him, Surge, you know, and people like Swab that has his podcast and that's getting this stuff there. People like you that's making this relevant. But I think we need more than, you know, the people that have been inside. It has to be bigger than that. Hopefully we continue to have momentum and get that ball rolling even more to kind of get that out there. So
I agree. And, you know, my question next was for you to think about, what does the phrase mass incarceration mean to you, especially as a Black man in today's society? And that question I'm asking you, but I also want the community to think about, like, What is mass incarceration? Because if you don't know, you need to know. You need to investigate.
I mean, it's just basically what I just said to you, man. I feel like it's a corrupted network of all of those things tied into one, whether it's the prosecution, whether it's the policing, incarceration. I think it's a system that's built upon reproducing economic and racial inequality and also oppression. That's what I feel as a Black man, as a minority on many fronts. That's what mass incarceration is. It is intended to keep the oppressed, and it is a system to continuously keep inequality breathing and living and surviving. And we all knew that. So that's what it means.
So, Michael, while being incarcerated, and I've asked this question to other individuals too, what is the majority of the population that is in prison right now?
The majority of the population that's in prison?
Yeah.
By the numbers, it's Black, you know, then it's white, and then it's Hispanic. But, you know, why it's so crazy that it's Black is because we make up the least amount of people in this population.
We make up 13%, but we're over 33% in prison. That's ridiculous. So that goes to tell you that the system is corrupted and the laws are put in place to continuously harm black men, black women, and to continuously create barriers in our neighborhood so that we can't thrive.
Do you feel by having such a large population, especially a race, you know, black, Latinos, having this population incarcerated and not in their communities is affecting the youth?
Is it what?
And I said, do you feel as though having such a large population incarcerated, blacks, Latinos, and so on, and not having them in their community, do you feel like that's also affecting the youth by not having those role models in the household? And like there's mothers, single mothers that are raising these kids. Do you feel like that is playing an effect on, you know, just like the incarceration rate that's going on right now too?
Well, I mean, of course it is. You know, we weren't made to raise families alone. That's not why we were created. If that was the case, then we wouldn't need each other. So it has to be a balance. And when any equation is thrown off balance, the equation becomes messed up, becomes wrong, can't get the correct answer out of it. Sometimes maybe you could put some alternative things there, some substitutes there, and you may get people that come out of it. That's great, but all in all, you know, it doesn't turn out to be a great, you know, combination. So for sure, the missing men that's behind a wall, that's missing from their communities, missing fathers, missing, you know, people being pillars in their communities, and, you know, people watching out for the older ladies and people watching out for the youth and people, you know, going to work every day and showing, you know, our youth what it is to work hard and be a stand-up person for your family. Of course, that being missing, those lessons being missing, are some of the reasons why people from my generation were even incarcerated. So it doesn't change. And I read an article one time. It's about these elephants in a safari, and they were these juvenile elephants, and they kept wondering why all the animals that popping up with missing limbs, some of them were dead. You see some of the animals, their stomachs were ripped out, and they did some surveillance, and they saw these, like, about six juvenile elephants that just were, like, running rampant and going up and causing terror. And, you know, what they did was they brought back the elder elephants, the older elephants. And as soon as they came back, the attitudes of the juveniles changed. And it wasn't because that they had influence. It was because the juveniles didn't know how to act, didn't know how to be mature, because they had nothing to look at. I think that's the same thing in our society. We didn't have a lot to look at back when, you know, mass incarceration started to pick up. They were taking our pillars out of the community. They were taking the older men that was carrying the groceries for Miss Lorraine down the block. They were taking the men that would take all the kids to the playground and buy them ice cream and water ice and throw the football with them. So we're missing that. And didn't know how to, you know, didn't know how to do it because we didn't have an example. So for sure, our men being out of the neighborhoods, our communities, and, you know, being leaders in our society is definitely changing what's happening in our communities.
I love the way that you put that, because we definitely do need to start breaking these cycles and start creating new cycles. Cycles that are completely different than what we're used to and that we think are normal, because they're not. So with that being said, you know, your home, I want to know, like, how has that transition been? And also, I know you're working currently, besides advocating, you're the director of Fountain Fun. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, your transition back because I know you're daddy. And then also, you know, talk about your work with Fountain Fund, but also the advocacy work that you're also doing in collaboration with Systematic Reformative Change.
Okay. So let's just start with the most thing I'm proud of right now is that I am a father.
Yes. Beautiful, and she's beautiful.
Baby girl named Aya. He's like my everything in my world. And it, you know, feels good to be her father and be the person that I am today. That she'll never have to know that guy from the past is like an amazing feeling to me. What else? As far as my job with the Fountain Fund, I am the director here in Philadelphia. And what the Fountain Fund is, it's a 501c3, and we specialize in providing capital exclusively. The only program in the country that is exclusively providing capital and education to those who were impacted by mass incarceration. We give out consumer loans, vehicle loans, housing loans, and entrepreneurial loans at a rate of 3% to 5%. And that's the work that I'm doing now. In regards to systematic reformative change, we're involved with trying to change the policy for second degree murder. We're also, you know, doing book bag drives for the kids. We're buying, you know, art sets and scientific kits, you know, for Haverford College, Girard College for those kids. Did that a couple times now. And we're just, you know, with systematic reformative change, we're just trying to bring awareness to the criminal justice system. We have an event this Saturday, 5 to 8 at Temple. Had the voices of our community. We have an all-women panel, and it's going to be real dope. And we're going to be talking about policy. We're going to be talking about systematic change. We're going to be talking about what's, you know, relevant in our society today, and, you know, some, you know, steps on how we can start to make a change and not just be people that's talking about things. Yeah, that's basically about it.
Well, can I just say your daughter is beautiful. I mean, she is beautiful. God bless her. She has all that hair. She's like a little doll baby. Yeah. And then I do want to say for anybody that's listening in, I mean, Fountain Funds, that is such an excellent resource, because a lot of people come home from being out of the system, or because they were in the system, they didn't have an opportunity to build credit. They don't have opportunities to get a good interest rate
with
other banks. So that's why y'all need to talk to Michael and his staff. Like, yeah, you know,
talk to me. Like, I mean, you know, like coming home, I had to do it the hard way. You know what I'm saying? And it, like I said, it was good because I created a network. The phone wants to be the network for people. I think, this program is so good because I don't think that society should have a say-so in when a person wants to attain freedom, right? I think that a person should attain freedom is as soon as they're ready to attain it. And what I mean by that, someone shouldn't, if you want to go out and you want to, you know, start your business, someone shouldn't be able to say to you, well, you don't have enough time out here yet to be able to do something like this. Why don't you give yourself 2 years and then we'll try to help you out then. I feel like that is just some of the freaking craziest things I've heard, even myself, personally, that someone would tell me when I could, you know, start to take hold of my life. And I believe that the Fountain Fund is a program that, you know, we're trying to change that. Specifically myself, you know, and I'm just in a great position, and I'm running this program here in Philadelphia. And, you know, just like Tina said, give me a call, come holler at me, and, you know, the things that you need, we'll get it done. And we'll try to help you get there, you know, and try to attain your freedom when you want it to be attained. Of course, if it doesn't make sense, no, I ain't going to be with it.
But if it do, you know what I mean, I'm going to try to get you there for sure. So
I think that's awesome. I did have a question. Do you guys provide like financial literacy classes for individuals that are just like coming home? And is this information being disseminated amongst those that are incarcerated, like even prior to coming home, so that they can start, you know, working on it? Because I know we talk about prison, but we don't talk about the things that aren't being taught, because I feel like things kind of stay stagnant. And, you know, sometimes they're not getting financial literacy classes. Not everybody's being educated. And sometimes that's depending on what your state is in that prison. Okay. So I think that when people are coming home, it's such a major transition in them finding resources, finding housing, maybe, you know, having that support system because they've been away from their family. And sometimes there's different rifts in relationships. So, and even navigating simple systems for us out here might be very frustrating. So is there like literacy classes or workshops where people can take part?
So for sure, the Fallon Fund is a particular resource. So we're not really designed for people getting right out of prison, like, because that's not even your first concern when you come home, right? Your first concern when you come home is not creating a business. You have so many other things that you want to do. Your first concern when you come home is not, you know, going to a dealership and buying a vehicle. That's not what you want to do. So the Fountain Fund is a part of the reentry process. And once you get to that point in your process, that's when I come in. But you know the work that I used to do. Like, you know, I'm a heavy advocate in the reentry, you know, field. So if someone was to come to me, I'm always going to try to help them get whatever it is that they need. And the Fountain Fund does have a lot of partnerships with organizations like you're talking about, like, you know, the financial literacy for people coming right home. I can definitely connect people to those resources. But as far as the Fountain Fund, we do have financial literacy for individuals that are trying to get our loans, our loan become in our loan portal. You have to complete a few classes of financial literacy to even start the process, because like I said, the Fountain Fund isn't just a place to give out money, but it is a place to educate and keep people away from the bad habits, practices, and, you know, falling into some bad things with their credit and their finances. So we want to teach people how to budget their money. We want to teach people about credit, how to use credit the correct way, and how to build credit the correct way. And we want to teach people how to continuously do that, so that they could teach those that are around them. So.
And can I just say too, like, you know, I know you're giving out this information, but just listening to you, I am so proud of you, because I know that when you came home, like, you got at it and you were very diligent at all the things that you wanted to accomplish and all the goals that you wanted to ascertain. And, you know, just having you on my show and listening to all the things that you're doing besides, you know, giving this good information to other people, just, you know, I'm really proud of you. I just want you to know that.
Well, I'm proud of you too. I'm proud of you too. You like the DJ of Philly now, so, you know.
Michael, I got like two more things that I wanted to go into with you, right?
Okay.
One of the things that I did want to ask is just basically, like, did you have any resources coming home? I know that you're giving them out, but did you get any resources?
Well, yeah.
In your transition?
I did, but again, it was because I had to learn about what reentry was. DOC, especially when I was inside, did a horrible job at preparing people to come home. Actually, that was my job for the DOC. I worked as the reentry freaking specialist for the DOC when I was in there. Based on you know, the program that we created with Man Up, I was the director of reentry for that program, and I started to work for the prison. But I educated myself on what reentry was and what I needed to survive. And
one of the things that I did while I was incarcerated, because I worked in that section, I saw people coming back every day, right? And they would have to come to the classes over there in that building. And oh boy, crap, Tina, I think I told you this before, but I had five notebooks filled up with reasons why people came back.
Wow. And
I studied them because I said, I can't do this. Like, I can't come back here. I can't put my family through this again. I just can't. You know what I'm saying? So I wrote down at least five notebooks of why people came in, whether it was bull crap or not, because you know you're going to hear those stories as well. But I filled my notebook up and I said, all right, what is this connected to? All right, this is connected to mental health, or this is connected to transportation, or this is connected to economics, getting a job. This is connected to, all right, boom. And that's how I built my network. So I knew exactly what I was going to need when I got home, outside of my family, who I got to give a big up to because they were great coming home. My little sister, Claire, was like my top dog, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's my little baby sister, and you met her before.
Yeah, I love her.
She was a rider for me, and my father, you know what I mean, obviously, you know what I'm saying, he was a rider for me. My mom, my sister, my other sisters, my older sisters, and my nephew, Amir, he was very instrumental when I came home. But outside of my family network, which was like a saving grace, I put together resources on the inside. So I knew I was going to need to have to talk to people, whether that was a group therapy, which we did with Man Up. So I kind of had that covered. My financial situation as far as my health care and welfare when I came home, that assistance that I was going to need, I knew who to go to for that. Transportation, you know, I knew about that. I didn't get on a bus or anything, but I had that set up for myself when I got home. And who was very instrumental was the Institute for Community Justice, ran by Asada Thomas. And she's no longer there anymore. So if you go there and it's bullcrap, can't blame it on me or her. We're no longer there. But she was very instrumental coming home. I thank her for a lot of things in my life. She kind of gave me a chance to like start being building freedom. You know what I'm saying? Like, she gave me my first opportunity to be able to go out in the world and say I'm providing for myself. Other than, you know, cutting hair when I came home in the pandemic, she gave me a chance to say I earn a salary. You understand? She gave me a chance to go inside of a bank and say, yeah, I have a job, and I have a 401k, and I have all this. Like, she gave me that opportunity, and for that, I'll be forever thankful. So that kind of a network, a great network when I came home.
That's what I'm talking about. Let's give a shout out to Asada Johnson.
Asada Thomas.
Thomas, I'm sorry. Yeah, now, before we end this, right? Asada Thompson, right? Let's give her a shout out because she's doing remarkable things out there in the community. I do want to say we have a 15 minute call of action, which I call a jail call because you got to put everything into that one phone call in 15 minutes. Like, you got to tell a story. So, you know, I'm sure people become great storytellers. But in a few words, I want you to give people out there a call to action, whether it's about what's taking place this Saturday at Temple, learning about second chances, or getting information on those literacy classes and receiving financial help with the Fountain Funds in two minutes. Give them a call to action.
So my call to action is, you know, always going to be for this population that's re-entering into society. My call is for organizations that are in nonprofit and specializing in helping people transition back in, to basically do what you say and whatever you promote to do it, because it is so hard coming home. and asking for help. So when people come and ask for help, please help them. Please give them the resources that you say that you have. Please have them. If you don't have them, be honest about it and send them somewhere where they can get it, because this is where we need to make the change. We've already been harmed going inside a prison. It is very traumatic also coming home to a new world, to a world that you can't hide from when you don't have knowledge of something. So when we reach out and we ask for help, please just help, you know. So, you know, as far as, you know, being active in that way, that's what I'm calling the people to do. Everybody in this space of reentry to help and do what it is that you say you can do.
I agree. Give that empathy, give that sympathy. Also, have that patience and also the respect for our loved ones that are coming home. I got to end this jail talk, but I do want to say thank you, Michael, for coming on my show. I want you to come back because this is a great conversation. You can hear jail talk every Friday at 4 p.m. Next on, we got DBI Live with Slav Gonzalez and Kevin McCracken.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I like Kev too. They're good people.
Yeah, I love them.
Cool. All right, T.
All right. Thank you again.
No problem.
Philadelphia, are you ready? City of Brotherly Love, home of Smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time, FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby, come on.